This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Death is a universal experience, but it's often not a topic people feel comfortable talking about. The University of Wisconsin-La Crosse recently held an international conference for professionals in end-of-life services to discuss the top issues facing the industry and encourage conversation about death, grief, and bereavement. Joining us now to talk about the conference and how they're hoping to influence conversation around loss and grief are Dr. Erica Srinivasan, director of UWL's Center for Grief and Death Education, and two presenters at the conference, Dr. Laurel Hilliker from the University of Michigan Flint and Laurel Burnett, a licensed mental health counselor from Formation Counseling Services in New Mexico. So death, grief, bereavement, these might seem like odd topics for a conference. So Dr. Srinivasan, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about kind of how this conference got started and you know, what's the hope for this, you know, get together?
Sure. Thanks for having us here today. We're all very enthusiastic to create awareness, I think, about death and loss and grief and bereavement. So the center initially started in Minnesota, started by Dr. Robert Fulton, who also started the first death and dying class in the United States. So started that in 1963, and then he started the center in 1969. And the conference was also initially held in Minnesota. And then upon his retirement, the center came here. And the conference for a while was at King's College, for about 20 years at King's College in Canada, and then came to UWL, and it's been here almost 20 years now. So a total of 42 years we've had the conference.
And Laurel, what do you think is the just the most helpful part of getting together to you know, talk about these issues, you know, for people who are working in kind of end-of-life care?
That's a great question. And I will preface my comments by saying this is my number one favorite conference. I've been a mental health counselor for 20 years, and this is about my eighth year coming here and doing presentations as well. And it's a phenomenal group of individuals that, again, are honoring the fact that loss and bereavement and the need to be able to have open dialogue about death and dying, you know, and aftercare is so vital. The part of what was so important about this year's conference is the focus on resiliency and self-care for the providers, because this is a very diverse community. There might be a funeral director, you know, social worker, nurse, a bedside nurse, hospice nurse, you know, child or infant, you know, oncology, you know, scholars, you know, individuals from academia and so forth. And we're able to get a very multifaceted look into what we're doing and how we can continue to educate.
As Laurel mentioned, you know, there's a wide variety of people who are attending and benefiting from the conference. And Dr. Srinivasan, I wonder if you could talk about, you know, are there takeaways you hope conference attendees kind of have from this conference?
Yeah, there are so many takeaways, I think. I would say it's sort of a broader perspective as we think about death and loss and grief is to always care about one another and to be kind to each other. So to use that awareness of death and loss and grief to inform, you know, how we live, how we are out in the world, and how we treat each other.
Dr. Hilliker, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you are presenting along with Laurel at this year's conference.
Sure. Well, Laurel and I we met at this conference. I'm from Michigan. She's from Albuquerque. And we formed a strong friendship at this conference about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, I guess. So we have co-presented before, and when we saw the theme for this year on resiliency, we both began to think about how we could contribute to that, myself as a sociologist and what I view is important in the field for these helping professionals, and Laurel's hands-on experience with her clients. And so we presented on resiliency in caregiving, and that could mean informal or formal caregiving. Many of these helping professionals are also caring for a family member, such as ourselves. We are caring for elderly parents. So we brought in some very practical tips alongside the research on caregiving and the challenges that people face, because a lot of the illnesses today and diseases last sometimes for decades. So how do we juggle all that, and how do we create a toolbox, if you will, a caregiver toolbox that's practical and we can take with us each day as we go into these environments, or we go home to, after working a 12-hour day, we go home to care for an elderly parent. So we try to give them some nuggets, if you will, to take and place in their, hopefully they've already developed a caregiver toolbox, but because many of them had talked to us about it, but at the same time, give them something from our presentation, and Laurel can explain some of the activities that we were able to do and which brought out stories.
Yeah, Laurel, I wonder if you want to elaborate on kind of, you know, how you wanted to interact with those listening to your presentation.
Right. We had an hour and 15 minutes for the presentation, and we probably had 4 hours at least worth of material. And then also the energy of the room gets woven into what we share. But we tried to hit the highlights of emphasizing self-care as well as honoring strength-based resiliency, that like we all have that, but oftentimes, you know, we might not give it as much self-credit, but in caregiving situations, it's really important to tap into what inherently every single individual is very good at doing. And one of the things I learned about Dr. Hilliker was that, you know, her primary strength as a caregiver is her strength in planning. And that was something that I hadn't even thought about for myself, but it made me ponder that, well, I can see that that's a strength I have as well. So perhaps I can, you know, think about that a little bit and weave that into my, you know, caregiving support. You know, what we were able to do was have little creativity kits. So we had given the participants a bright green leaf, and we asked each person to identify what their strength in turn was, you know, for them in caregiving, and then to be able to populate a tree. So in drawing out a trunk, if everybody puts the leaves on the trees, all of a sudden, you know, there's the potential for 45 ideas of strengths within the caregiving continuum. And sometimes by listening to another person's story or hearing different ways that self-care is integrated, it's a great way to be able to say, like, I can do that. I'll start doing that. I'll mention this to my brother and sister, or I'll mention this to my parents, and we can all be a little bit more proactive on our self-care.
Yeah, Dr. Hilliker, you mentioned that, you know, this doesn't just apply to people who provide care as their profession, but also those who are maybe providing care for a loved one. And I wonder if you could kind of elaborate on how, you know, a lot of these issues apply to people in those situations as well.
Oh, certainly. A lot of challenges in the 21st century caregiving scenario, if you will, because of these illnesses and the medications and all the things that we can do to prolong life for people. And typically we all want to live a long life, even if the quality of life is not exactly what we would, you know, had expected. So in the personal caregiving of someone you love, you know, you need to be able to recognize, have these self-reflection moments. We talked about those, and have a self-awareness of what your needs are. Because if you burn out as a caregiver in year 5 and you've got 10 more to go, you're going to be in trouble. So creating a support system, and in many of the presentations, the speakers talked about the geographic mobility of the family. So it's harder as we're, you know, I have siblings in several different states, so it's harder to create that support sometimes. And we don't neighbor. I think it was Dr. Boss who pointed out that, you know, we don't have the neighborhoods that we used to have 50 years ago when we were caregiving. So we can't count on them. So we have to get creative and have these awareness moments so that we can provide that support, that safety net, and take care of ourselves by having respite and having, I almost canceled this trip because my mother actually at 89 fell and broke her kneecap. And so I had to reach out to my Michigan siblings who are very busy professionals and see what days they could come and whether or not this was a reality for me to make this trip. And I've been coming here for 10 years, so it's part of my self-care to come to La Crosse because these people have become like family to me. They are very, very supportive, and they care about you. They check in on you from time to time, and they know, you know, through social media and so forth, that you've had a loss or that you need some extra support.
That's Dr. Laurel Hilliker from the University of Michigan and Flint campus here with us today in light of a recent conference on death, grief, and bereavement here at UWL. Also joining us are other presenters at the conference, Laurel Burnett, mental health counselor from New Mexico, and Dr. Erica Serini-Vossen from UWL. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Dr. Hilliker, I wonder if being a caregiver in your personal life has changed your perspective as a professional who looks at these issues.
Absolutely, yes. Being the oldest daughter in my family and a lot of the caregiving resting on me because I chose to come home to Michigan as my parents were getting elderly, it really opened my eyes to the importance of living gently and loving deeply and just being able to understand that people are carrying big things. They may not talk about it, but the more you have these experiences in your life, the more it opens your eyes to the fact that other people may be caregiving for a special needs child or, you know, whatever the situation is. Our lives are more complex in this 21st century landscape. So it has changed me. It has strengthened me. It has shown me my strengths, my resilience in many different ways.
Laurel, I know that you are also, you know, a caregiver in your personal life as well as in your professional one. And you know, I wonder if you could talk about, you know, how you see the two, if they are similar in what ways and if they're different in others.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point for individuals to look at what they do professionally, but then also look at how that weaves into what is experienced personally. One of the major factors that I feel, you know, that can be looked at is some kind of pre-planning for what the family, and that can be defined as a lot of different things, what the family, you know, caregiving needs are. You know, my parents are 86 and almost 90, and they're so very dynamic that I feel I receive from them, like in a caregiving mode or being able to learn how to age from watching them be resilient. So I sometimes do think of it as caregiving, but sometimes more so care sharing. Like, how can we, you know, be supportive of one another? How can we have open discussions about, like, what our preferences are? What are our, you know, wishes regarding going to the ER or urgent care or being open to palliative care? You know, talking with hospice, you know, when the medical provider, you know, anticipates that, you know, a disease, you know, might render life at like 6 months or less. There's all these different types of issues that can be planned for, discussed, you know, hashed over, you know, contemplated, pondered before a crisis. And that was one thing during several years when my mom had multiple like major medical issues coming up. Sometimes mom just wasn't sure what she wanted. Like, well, I'll have to think about it some more, or I'll let you know. And at times the urgency, you know, requires a faster decision. And so what I would often share with mom is, well, in the absence of a plan, you know, I will do everything I can to be present for the crisis. And I will try and honor your wishes. I will try and uphold, like, all of your values and what I know. But I would much rather know what your wishes are ahead of time so that we can be proactive as a family.
You know, Dr. Srinivasan, I think that this is an interesting conversation happening in La Crosse because, you know, I think our community sometimes has a reputation of you know, being really upfront about talking about end-of-life care and kind of has a reputation of one of the best places to die. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. That's an odd thing. But I wonder if you could talk about, you know, about that aspect of having this, you know, this type of education, this type of conversations happening in this community.
Yeah, I'm so proud that we have this conference and that this is a topic of conversation in the community. I do, and I think one of the reasons it has the reputation of being the best place to die is that there's a high advanced directive completion rate. So that means that people are talking about their end of life wishes, but that's still kind of limited to the context of doctor's appointments in the hospitals, and so we still find, I think, that there's a lot of work to be done to address that stigma or how that death can be a taboo topic. Though La Crosse is a little bit ahead of than compared to other places in the country, but it's always struck me oddly that it's a taboo topic, considering it's, you know, one of the things we all have in common, and so my goal really is to keep continuing those conversations. So with the center, one of the things we've done is collaborate with other places in town, with Viterbo University and community partners, to hold death cafes to just a place where people can gather and chat about death, any topic within, you know, death, dying, grief, and loss.
Do you think there's any change to the way that we approach death now versus 10 years ago? I mean, do you think that those conversations are progressing, or there's still, you know, a lot of work to be done there?
I think there it's kind of two answers to that. It's progressing in some way. So we have we've got death cafes, or we have things like this conference, or I teach a death and dying course here at UWL. So there's interest in talking about it. And there's people talking about it, but it's also constantly evolving. So end-of-life care is constantly evolving in the types of conversations we have about it. So compared to 10 years ago, conversations have changed. So we're talking more about different end-of-life care options, such as, you know, assisted death or different types of bereavement, and different conversations about loss. So acknowledging that loss is not only from death, but it's that we experience loss in different ways and every day. So it's a conversation that's progressed in the sense, I think we talk about it more each decade, but what we're talking about changes over time.
I wonder if you could expand on that, the idea that losses can be from other things than just death, and kind of what that could look like.
Sure. So in my death and dying class, I have students, when we talk about loss and grief, make a list of losses that they experience in life. And at first, you know, death comes to mind pretty readily for most people when you hear the word loss, and that it's certainly a big loss. But as we talk more, they're able to make, you know, quite a big list, such as things of, you know, loss of a relationship, a breakup with a partner, with a loved one, or dealing with the divorce of a parent, so loss of your family unit as you once knew it. Or one of the topics I presented on at this year's conference was on living with or coping with early onset dementia, so coping with the loss and grief that comes with that. So, you know, people who are living and navigating an illness and all of the losses that they experience throughout that illness process.
I want to return to talking more about your presentation in a moment, but Laurel, I wonder if you could expand on, you know, how thinking about loss is not just about death, how that's maybe influencing kind of your industry and people who are, you know, providing mental health support.
Uh-huh. That's a great topic, and it's one that, like, through whether it's individual counseling, education seminars, you know, workshops, support groups, something that can provide education and awareness about grief and loss, because oftentimes, you know, we first learn about grief from our childhood experiences, and, you know, it might be the death of a pet or the death of a grandparent, but with these other losses, if a child has grown up and never known an intact family, like the impact of separation and divorce, of a fractured, you know, family system, and the impact that has across the developmental ages, there's so many opportunities where individuals get to a point in life where, like, the ability to cope or to maintain at work and school, at a relationship, you know, at maintaining life balance, it gets to more of a crisis point. So at the point that an individual's willing to seek some additional services, it's a great opportunity for mental health providers to be able to also focus on mental health wellness and be able to, again, look at what the resiliency is that allows the individual to have already kind of survived what they have, but then how can we look back at any type of trauma? How can we look at, you know, what the individual knows about grief and loss? And oftentimes we do need to provide education, because a lot of individuals equate having to go to a counselor, or they equate the acute pain of grief to, well, I must be losing my mind, or I'm, you know, coming unglued, or my friends are saying that I'm, you know, mental, or I need help. And we're trying to destigmatize that and create awareness of a normal and natural process of grief as part of being human.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about loss and grief and how professionals gathered at a UWL conference are hoping to change the public and professional approach. We're here with some of the presenters, Laurel Burnett, a mental health counselor from New Mexico, Dr. Laurel Hilliker from the University of Michigan Flint campus, and Dr. Erica Srinivasan from UWL. Dr. Hilliker, earlier you mentioned that, you know, kind of a theme is, you know, developing resiliency for caregivers. And, you know, I wonder if you could talk about, you know, whether you think that caregivers, whether in the professional sphere, people providing, you know, services for end of life, but also in the personal sphere, if people are always prepared enough to step into that role as a caregiver.
Yeah, that's exactly what we talked about in our presentation. And you know, when I first heard about all these ideas from different disciplines about self-care, so that we didn't have, you know, compassion fatigue and burnout and all these things that go with either informal or formal caregiving, I thought, I can't do one more thing. My day is full. But once you learn how to weave those things that are important to you that bring you to a peaceful state, the more, you know, the more you'll realize how beneficial it is in the long run. We talked about developing critical problem-solving skills and spirituality by cultivating gratefulness and, you know, all the little things that you can do, just taking moments to breathe. Those are important in both the personal caregiving and the professional caregiving professions. So,
yeah, and Dr. Srinivasan, I know that here at UWL, you're teaching, you know, death and dying courses, kind of preparing people to approach those conversations in their professional sphere. I wonder what you hope your students take away from those classes, you know, into their professions.
I hope they. Yeah, one of the things I want them to sort of look at their own relationship to death and loss, and to sort of understand where they're coming from, and maybe know what their own anxieties are, but also what their strengths are, and to not, you know, not to be embarrassed about their their anxieties, but just to really know what they are, so you know what you're getting into when you're serving other people, so you can best serve other people. So to really understand themselves and also understand their strengths, too, to know how to best serve others. I also, I guess I go back to kind of also what I said generally from the conference, the takeaway of just realizing you never know what the person next to you has gone through, and it's important to be kind to one another.
Mm-hmm. And at the conference, you're presenting, as you mentioned, about early onset dementia. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about kind of the unique challenges that sometimes comes with that that diagnosis.
Yeah, there really are a lot of unique challenges that come for anybody with a dementia diagnosis, but particularly when you have that early or young onset and you're diagnosed at that younger age. So there's navigating whether or not you let people know, you know, at work, and then having to think about possibly early retirement and how you're going to access healthcare and insurance. There's also things like worrying about children and relationships with them, but also, or do they have a genetic predisposition to this illness? So there's really quite a lot of things unique to their age group, and then just generally losses that they're dealing with, such as like changing relationships, as maybe their partner is still their partner, but also becoming a caregiver, so changing roles in the family relationship. And dealing with stigma, too, from responses from other people. So people I ran some focus groups in town, and the people spoke about their subjective experiences. So I interviewed people living with early onset dementia, and they talked about how they'd get responses from people saying, like, well, you look so healthy, or, well, but you're young. That's an older person's disease. You couldn't possibly have this. And that really sort of minimize their feelings and shut down their, made them less willing to talk, to express their grief. So that really has an impact on grief with that stigma or that lack of awareness about what the disease entails. And then there's a lot to do with loss of independence, too, as the disease progresses, and not being able to maybe drive anymore or participate in a person's, some of their favorite activities. So it really impacts that quality of life.
I think this is an interesting topic because, you know, a lot of times when we talk about loss, we think about loved ones who are, you know, dealing with the loss of a family member to death or you know, losing a family member to dementia. But, you know, that person, that patient is also experiencing their own losses.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're navigating their own losses throughout that illness process and anticipating that. Impending death, and then the caregiver too is, you know, coping with their own losses, and I think both the person with dementia and their caregiver, that dyad, they're also grieving for each other and the losses that each other are experiencing.
You know, these are very heavy topics, but, you know, Dr. Hilliker, you mentioned that you really enjoy coming to this conference and coming here. I wonder if you could share. I don't know if there are moments of kind of light shared at the conference as well.
Absolutely, especially when I meet a student who's attending the conference, maybe a future nurse or a future social worker, because I think we have made progress in our field, but we have a long way to go. These professionals that come have been in the field and they need this, you know, these updated theories and so on and so forth, but so too do the new future professionals that are going out there. They're going to be at the bedsides, they're going to be working with families. And it's just always, I feel very passionate about educating people with, you know, the theories that they need for today's people who are dying and grieving, not from 40 or 50 years ago that the, you know, perhaps they're getting from other sources. So seeing that and hearing that from new attendees is just delightful to me.
How do you think those needs have changed?
The needs of people?
You mentioned, you know, kind of taking the needs of those people who are, you know, dying today and instead mm-hmm. of those who were going through that process, you know, 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what changes you see in that.
Well, from a sociological perspective, I see that, you know, our society has moved away from the authority of religion, for example, and replaced that authority with the self. So today's dying people and families don't necessarily talk a lot about their faith, even though they might identify as, you know, with a particular faith. They have a tendency to be absorbed in the medicalization experience of death. So with the hospital environment, I know when I did my research on baby boomers who had lost spouses, they talked a lot about the lack of coordination of care. So all these things shaped their bereavement. And so I think that we have different values. Our values are changing a little bit in our society, and certainly the authority is changing, as well as our communication. We have more, you know, social communication online, right? So with all those changes, we look at different things in those experiences. And it certainly has changed. If I would have done my study 50 years ago, I think I would have heard more about prayer and calling the priest, whereas these people that I interviewed, even though they identified with a particular religion, I had to, after a two-hour interview, I decided to ask them if they had done those things. They didn't bring them up, even though they were practicing their faith. So I think I saw that shift in the authority in our society was shaping their experience.
Dr. Laurel Hilliker from the University of Michigan's Flint campus is here with us today in light of an international conference on death, grief, and bereavement recently held at UWL. She's joined by Laurel Burnett, a mental health counselor from New Mexico, and Dr. Erica Srinivasan from UWL. Coming up, we'll talk with a doctor from the La Crosse area who's taking a unique approach to the end-of-life care. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. La Crosse has been described as one of the best places to die because of an emphasis in the community on thinking about end-of-life care. One doctor is taking a unique approach to this type of care by using her skills as a death doula to help patients and family members prepare for death. Joining us now is Dr. Jackie Yeager from La Crosse. And first, Dr. Yeager, could you explain what a death doula is?
Well, sure. I get that question quite a bit. And it's a new vocation that's developing. And it's based on the concept of a birth doula and or a birth midwife. But people have discovered that sometimes they need someone who is skilled and experienced to guide them through the dying process as well. So a death doula, while it's not completely well-defined at this point because it's still new, but to me it's someone who assists people with the process of dying, like a birth doula assists someone with the process of giving birth.
Yeah, when did this, I guess, kind of this field start, this movement start of looking for kind of this non-traditional approach to end-of-life care?
Well, it's probably don't have a specific date for it yet because there's no certifying body, there's no, like, point in time, but I would say over the last 5 to 7 years probably.
And so you are also a palliative care doctor, and so you have maybe the more traditional, experience approach to end-of-life care. I wonder if you could maybe compare and contrast the two mindsets.
Well, when I now have a private practice in palliative care where I just do home visits, but up until a year ago, I was working within the system, and I knew my medications pretty well, but I wanted to seek out some more of the sacred space that I see when I'm with someone who's dying, and I wanted to learn more about ritual and ceremony and just how we could elevate the dying process to sort of its more rightful place in our society. And so when I chose the death doula training program that I did, it was one that didn't emphasize the practical
parts about dying, but the spiritual parts. And so I chose the Conscious Dying Institute in Boulder. And Taryn Estes is the originator of that program. And it's very Boulder. And I remember her wondering if any place in the Midwest could be as progressive. And I said, oh, yes, La Crosse is very progressive, particularly when it comes to death and dying. So,
yeah, I wanted to touch on this idea because La Crosse kind of does have that reputation of not being afraid to have these conversations about end-of-life care. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what that looks like here and why you think there is such a different mindset or a different approach to this.
Well, yeah, I think overall, even outside of La Crosse, people are very hungry to talk about death. They're becoming much more open, and it's happening really quickly. There's just this huge, like, awakening about, gosh, maybe we should take a hold of this dying process. And it might be the baby boomers. You know, they've always been ones to change society and to say, hey, I want to have some say-so in how this happens. And advanced care planning certainly talks about who will be your decision maker and maybe some basic details. But a death doula, at least in my program, I sit down and we develop a dying time care plan where we really look at the spiritual, emotional, physical, psychological, and practical aspects of dying. And we think about sort of where we want to be at that time, what is our vision for our dying time in each of those areas, and then where are we now in each of those areas, and what are the steps we need to take to make this happen. So I might think that I want certain kind of music when I'm dying, but until I tell somebody, make a list, maybe have them put together a playlist for me, then it's not really going to be accessible to me. So that's just a simple example of how we get from sort of where we're at now to where our vision is.
Why do you think those kinds of conversations around death and dying haven't necessarily been happening until up until this point?
Well, I think Western culture is a little reluctant to think about and talk about things we can't completely control and that we can't completely understand. And there's so much mystery about the dying process. We have a little bits of knowledge from people who've gone through near-death experiences. But so I think it takes some courage to really look at this thing called death and kind of lean into it. And people are sort of awakening to that. In Eastern culture and many religions, they study death throughout their lives. And this is particularly the Buddhist culture. And really the idea is not so that I will have the perfect death, but so that I will live my life more fully. And I think when we frame it that way, people are much more open to talking about it.
You mentioned earlier the idea of developing a sacred space for dying. And I wonder if you could just talk about what that is, what that looks like.
Well, I think it starts with a calm presence in the room. So when I come in, and I've been through this process before, and I use some of my mindfulness practices in my own head to calm myself, then everyone else in the room can kind of relax and stop trying to fix, stop trying to manage the death. So I provide that calm presence, and then I look around and I try to see, or I talk to the family and I try to think about what was important to this person. And if it's a religious affiliation, then we certainly want to draw on that for our rituals. But oftentimes it may be their experience in the military, and you can see something on the wall that says this being a Marine was important to him. So maybe then I will draw on some patriotic music or something to play at the bedside and have the family help by singing some of those songs. I carry with me my go bag, and I have essential oils, and I have candles, and I have rose petals. And there's sort of just some very simple ritual rituals that you can develop with things that are right there in the room, as long as you have water and something like rock that simulates the earth, and fire, candles, you can just develop a very simple either honoring ritual for someone or perhaps a letting go kind of ritual. Maybe everyone in the room holds a stone and thinks about one thing that this person is worried about as they're dying and then drops it in the water. And then everyone drops in a rose petal for the blessings that this person may have provided for the family, and just out loud honoring their life story.
You know, it sounds like this work is not only about providing comfort as someone passes, but about comforting their family, their loved ones who are gathered there. I mean, how much of your work do you feel like focuses on those people in the room as well?
Well, it's both, and it's easy to sometimes get swept up in the family drama, and sometimes you can come into the room and think, my goodness, the patient's been forgotten here. And so then I might really focus my attention on what I'm sensing, maybe their fear or a physical symptom. But oftentimes the patient is very comfortable, because I can give the good drugs too, which is a great part of, not every death doula has that access, but so if I can get the patient comfortable, but the family's still struggling, and families are always messy, and and the worst of us comes out during this dying time. And so, I'd say at least 50% of my work is in helping the family, because I figure that is going to have an impact for years and years to come. And maybe even modeling a calmness during the dying will affect the grandchildren in the room and how they look at death in the future.
That's Dr. Jackie Yeager here with us today to talk about end-of-life care and the needs of patients and their loved ones. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Earlier you mentioned that there seems to be a change in mindset of how people are thinking about, the end of their lives and preparing for their death. And I wonder if you could talk more about some of these generational differences we're seeing in talking about death and how you see those continuing in the future.
Sure. One movement that I find fascinating is the Death Cafe movement. And this is something that started in the UK and has now gone worldwide. And it's death cafes are just opportunities to sit down with strangers, have a little cake and tea, and talk about death. And we had one recently we've had six in La Crosse so far, but one that was amazingly well attended. There were 68 people at the one that we had at the Franciscan Spirituality Center. So we had tables of eight, and each table would have a conversation. And each table had multiple generations in it. We had young college students, we had octogenarians, and it's interesting for me to think about it may be easier for someone who's younger to say, oh, yeah, death's just part of the life, part of life. But as you get closer and closer to that age when you might be dying, your perspective is going to change. And so there was a lot of intergenerational conversation going on at the table, which I think is so powerful for both age groups.
I know that, a big part of your work is making house calls, going to where the patient is. I wonder if you could talk about, why that's important and if you see that as a trend that's going to continue in healthcare, this return to the doctors visiting people in their home.
Well, I hope so. For me, it's the best way to assess a patient is to see them in their environment. You just get so much more information. It's more convenient for them, of course, also, but it's really about doing even better medicine when I can see them in the setting of their families. There is a trend, something called direct primary care coming around the country, and it has a similar pricing model to my practice, where there's a membership fee, and that covers all of your primary care for the month. And in those practices, the doctors are really leaving the system, starting their very own small solo practices, maybe in a one-room office, and lowering their overhead so that they can do things like home visits. They have enough time. They don't have to see 10,000 patients. You know, they don't have to have that many on their panel. And so, and they're finding the joy of medicine. It's like pure doctoring. I love my job now, you know. And so there's got to be a change because our doctors are burning out. And our patients aren't really happy all the time with how they're accessing care, especially our very elderly and those with, I mean, that's really who I seek to serve, are those people that really truly struggle to be able to get into the clinic for appointments. And right now we don't have any other community-based palliative care in La Crosse, so I'm kind of hopefully starting a trend and we'll be able to grow so that I can help, and I'd love to have some partners eventually to share responsibilities with, too.
What drew you to this work?
Well, let's see. So I've been a family physician for 28 years, and the first half of my career, I did a lot of obstetrics, and then I gradually worked, when my mom was dying, really developed an interest in end-of-life care, and I discovered how similar the intimacy and the sacred nature of dying is to being with someone who's giving birth. And so I was drawn to it because it's intense and it's intimate and it's it just feeds my soul. End-of-life care, most people that work in end-of-life care do have a story about someone who's dying. And also there's been some tragedy in my life that's kind of woke me up a few years ago to how we need to live each day because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And so I said, I'm just going to take this leap and start this little private practice and, you know, kind of hope for the best. So
I wonder if there is a downside, an emotional toll that this work can have on you, being with, you know, so many people as they pass and kind of witnessing that grief and loss.
Yes. And I think that is a problem potentially with doctors in palliative care, in any of the end-of-life providers, nurses, hospice workers. And for me, what's helped is an approach using mindfulness. And so I can be compassionate with someone. I can be truly with them, but at the same time, I'm aware of my thoughts. I'm aware of when my emotion starts to get triggered, and I can kind of let that go. And that really prevents me from being overwhelmed. They use a term in Buddhism called equanimity, where we just are able to truly be compassionate but not take on the suffering too much ourselves. And it really also serves the patient well, because if I am too empathetic and I start sobbing at the bedside, I don't really provide that sort of safe space for the family to grieve. You know, I need to be in control of my emotions so that I can act skillfully. I can provide that calm, you know, balanced presence in the room and then allow the family to fall apart if they need to.
You know, we've talked about how La Crosse is a community that is aware of you know, preparing for end of life. But I wonder if there is, I don't know, there's still more progress that needs to be done in talking about death or mindful dying, as I know that you kind of described this process in this community.
Well, there are some number of different events coming up. I'm giving a day-long conference at the Spirituality Center just on how to be with dying and, you know, how do we, even for our loved ones, apply these mindful concepts in order to sit at the bedside and kind of be a doula for our family members. So I don't think somebody necessarily has to be a professional doula in order to develop some of these skills. So I really look forward to some of the teaching that's coming up to help our community really tackle the tough stuff, but do it mindfully. And who knows where that could lead? La Crosse has been a leader in the world on dying issues, so it'll be exciting to see.
We've been talking with Dr. Jackie Yeager about her work as a death doula, providing end-of-life care for patients and support for grieving loved ones. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview with presenters from the International Death, Grief, and Bereavement Conference at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.